has tried to implement George Orwell's dream in 1984, or at least his nightmare, the one where Big Brother spread slogans around, things like war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. I'm certain that Bush believes in that mantra, or at least believes in propagating it. So I gotta say, it wasn't surprising to me to see him blame the entire Iraq war as not my fault. I expect we'll hear a lot of that in the blessed few remaining 48 days of the Bush administration. If you're like me, you've got a marker on your wall. Okay, 48 days. We're under 50 now, 47. Tomorrow, 46. Can our country survive? I don't know. Each day, we get a day more. But, so, Bush is not my fault. No. The intelligence messed up. You know, George Bush was never asked about, or at least he never responded to, or at least if he were responded to, I'm sure he would never answer the quite pithy statement in the Downing Street memo. You remember that. The memo where the British functionary was simply down there to take notes at the meeting. And he remarked, quite simply, that Bush was more interested in fixing the facts around the policy, fixing the intelligence around the preconceived notions. And George Bush blames the intelligence? You know how intelligence works. Intelligence is not Iraq, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, or Al-Qaeda is going to attack on September 11th at 9 a.m. That's not how intelligence works. Intelligence is all about, as they told us back after September 11th, it's all about connecting the dots. And there are thousands, indeed, I'm sure tens or hundreds of thousands, of dots. And George Bush looked at 99,999 dots, all of whom said that Saddam Hussein is contained, that he's a nasty dictator, but at least as of 2002, was far weaker than he'd been even during prior to the Gulf War, prior to the invasion of Kuwait back in 1991, that he was one of the weakest dictators in the region, that he was not killing people randomly, in fact, that he was probably doing less damage than our friendly dictatorships, you know, friendly to the United States, not very friendly to their own people, places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, where our friendly dictator Mubarak was in control. No, Saddam Hussein was contained more than the Soviet Union was contained, and we didn't invade them either. So 99,000 pieces of intelligence tell us no problem. But then there's one. There is one that says that he's building WMDs, and it's by an agent named Curveball, who's dismissed by German intelligence as untrustworthy and has data that's several years old. And Dick Cheney went down to the bowels of the CIA, stood over the shoulders of the agents. Oh, that can't be intimidating. Having the Vice President of the United States, who you know wants to see any evidence you have that lets him go to war. And they cherry-picked intelligence. Oop, nope, can't take that cherry, it's ripe. Nope, can't take that cherry, it's ripe. Ooh, those thousand cherries, they're ripe, they're plump, they're juicy. We'll avoid them. There's one that's rotten. Pick that. Print it up. Show it to the president. Fill the National Intelligence Estimate of 2002 with all the rotten cherries picked from the tree of intelligence. And then you'll put the ripe ones in there. They'll just be in the footnotes. They won't be in the executive summary, which is all that members of Congress are mostly reading. It's all that the administration's mostly reading. And you'll have them there, but you have to go to a secure room miles away and sit for hours. And, well, no member of Congress will do that. Very few did. Bob Graham of Florida gets credit. He did. Senator Graham of Florida. One of the few to read the entire report and to warn us, hey, the summary doesn't match what's in the data. But George Bush blames the intelligence? He blames those hardworking men and women that are trying to save our country from some real, dangerous, terrorist threats. You know how the Republicans claim that anytime you don't support the Cheney, Roe, Bush policy. Well, you don't support our troops. When, of course, Americans aren't attacking our troops, we're trying to bring our troops home. No one doubts the bravery of the men and women risking their lives every day in Iraq and Afghanistan and places around the globe. No one doubts their sacrifice. We've all seen them, missing arms and legs, even if their funerals are not shown on television. No, Democrats support our troops. We don't support that wacko at the top who gave them orders. But Bush doesn't seem to support our troops, at least not our intelligence troops. It's all their fault. It's all the intelligence analysts' fault. They shouldn't have let me cheat them. They shouldn't have let me push them around. They should have said, Mr. President, stop trying to mess with my evidence. I would have fired him, sure. But they should have been fired. When I pressed them to manipulate the intelligence, they should have told me no. You know, as much as we may condemn George Tenet, and rightly so, for being a bit of a yes man, okay, a lot of a yes man, both for, you know, Bill Clinton and for George Bush, it's worth repeating that those famous words, the ones that George Bush gave in his State of the Union address, the one that said that Saddam Hussein was trying to get quantities of uranium from a country in Africa. In other words, he was trying to nuke people. It's worth repeating that George Tenet turned that down again and again and again. Stephen Hadley was mainly the one trying to push it in, that neoconservative lackey, doing his best to fix the facts around the policy. Those damn facts. Fix the facts around the policy. The policy is invade Iraq. Now make up a reason. It's worth noting that Stephen Hadley told George Tenet to put it in. George Tenet said no. Hadley put it in again. Tenet said no again. Hadley said put it in a third time, and this time George Tenet apparently missed it. It got in under his nose. Because you know, when you keep trying to trick people again and again and again, sometimes they get tired. Sometimes they don't do their job. So shame on you, George Tenet. But a much greater shame on Stephen Hadley and the Bush administration for trying to stick that faulty intelligence in the report. You know, there's a difference, right? I fault George Tenet. I fault Colin Powell for spreading misinformation. But at least they tried to keep it out. And George Bush? You know, maybe he is a useful idiot. That would not surprise me. I've attended conferences where we've had long debates on this point. Is George Bush incompetent or malevolent? Is he a bumbling idiot or is he an evil menace? And we have long, very heated arguments on this topic until finally at one of these conferences I remember raising my hands and say, can't we all get along? Incompetence and malevolence are not mutually exclusive. He can be both. He can be both. Let's all agree he can be both. So maybe George Bush didn't quite realize the extent that Cheney and Roe were manipulating the intelligence. I don't know. I don't care. The effect is the same. And now in his swan song, George Bush is saying, it's not my fault. Not my fault. No. The intelligence was wrong. The intelligence was wrong. When I and my people tried thousands and thousands of times to manipulate the intelligence, they only stopped us 999 times. The thousandth time, they didn't stop us. We snuck in a lie. It's their fault. They should have barred the door. It's kind of like having, you know, 1,000 bank robbers try to rob a bank at the same time, and the police stopped 999 of them. And, well, they let one in. And so the bank robbers blame the police for letting them in the bank. That's George Bush saying the intelligence failure in Iraq. I don't know if you saw the interview with Charles Gibson. I'll try to play it maybe in the later half of the hour. I don't have it queued up. But it was fascinating when you heard Charlie Gibson ask him about this, and he blames the faulty intelligence, and Charlie Gibson says, but what if you'd known? What if you'd known the truth? Would you have still gone to war in Iraq? And Bush, great Freudian slip, Bush says, you mean what if the weapons of mass destruction had been there? And Charlie Gibson says, no. What if you'd known the truth that they weren't there? Oh, well, I don't know. I never thought about it. I mean, there were just, you know, 4,000 Americans dead and 100,000 Iraqis and 30,000 wounded, and it's a continuing war and it cost $10 trillion. I never thought about whether or not it was a good idea or not. If I'd known the truth. No, I did think about the fact that, whoa, I sure wish he'd had those WMDs. You see how Bush's mind works. Instead of thinking, should I have gone to insist on an unjustified war, the question, oh, normal human beings would think, Bush thought, what if I'd only had justification for the war I'd begun? Fixing the facts around the policy. Even in his own mind, even on national television, even before Charlie Gibson says, what if you'd known the truth? And Bush says, you mean what if he'd had WMDs? No. Not how could you have better justified your war, but should you have gone to war without justification? Not my fault. Not my fault. Well, Bush is doing his best to give us a legacy that will last us a long time. He is promulgating regulations, careful to make sure they go into effect just before Inauguration Day, just to make it as difficult as possible for President Obama to undo them. As Bob Kincaid and other West Virginians know, one of the things that he did just this week was make sure that all the rubble from mountaintop removal can be deposited in West Virginia's pristinely clear rivers and lakes and stuff, because water, overrated. More important that we get that coal. And, you know, I mean, this way, the roads in West Virginia have to go up and down mountains. He's making it all easier for West Virginians. He's creating the Appalachian Plateau, the Appalachian Plains, the Appalachian Flats. You simply take a mountain, turn it upside down, stick it in the valley, let all the rubble go into your streams and waters, and it makes West Virginia uninhabitable, but, you know, it gives power for a short time to people all across America. And if West Virginians don't like it, well, they can leave. They can pick up their banjos and go. It's not just West Virginia. In Utah, very conservative state, but some of the most beautiful natural rock formations in the world. If you've ever been to Utah, you've seen that. Get rid of the people, save the environment, because Utah is a beautiful place. Well, he's going to make sure that we can do mining in those areas too. You see, Bush wants his legacy to last a long time, and unless you completely disrupt the environment, that's hard to do. So, well, that's what he's doing. It's funny because his time is drawing to a close, and I think so many Americans are focusing on the upcoming administration, and that's understandable, the excitement of a new president, a new Congress, finally one that represents the American people, finally one committed to help ordinary people rather than the super rich, that people aren't noticing that George Bush is trashing the place before he leaves. Even the economy, the thing that Americans are most concerned about, they're more focused on Obama's economic team than they are George Bush's current economic policies. And again, I mean, I get it. We're all tired of George Bush. No one, I assure you, more than I, looks forward to the day when I never have to mention that. I have to stop myself to say some things sometimes. Let's just say that worst president in all of American history ever again. I look forward to that day. But we got 48 days to go. And George Bush is trying to rival Herbert Hoover for the worst economic policy. See, it ain't just the war. It ain't just lying against him in the war. It isn't just, you know, letting all those people die during Katrina. It's not just all the corruption and all the massive spending in good times so that we have a massive deficit in bad times. It isn't just ending regulation so that people can gamble on all these Wall Street and elsewhere that drive the whole world economy into the dust. No, George Bush is actually practicing the policies of Herbert Hoover that deepened the recession into the Great Depression. I mean, when the stock market fell in October 1929, the economy didn't immediately go into a depression. It was not doing well, to be sure, but that took some time. It took effort. Hoover had to work hard in 1930 and 31 and 32 to take a stock market crash and turn it into the greatest depression in American history. He worked hard on it and he succeeded. But Herbert Hoover, at least we can say about Hoover, he didn't have the benefit of hindsight, right? He probably didn't have the benefit of John Maynard Keynes and Keynesian economics and the understanding that everyone learns in economics today, as I was taught, as any economist is taught. Liberal, conservative, you name it. That when you're in the middle of a Great Depression, you need fiscal and monetary stimulus to get you out. That's pretty basic. If you don't know that, you will fail your macroeconomics class in any college in the United States, with the possible exception of Liberty University, where I assume they teach you that praying is the best way to get the country out of a depression. But Herbert Hoover didn't have the benefit of modern economics, I guess. I guess that's why I actually believe that Hoover, unlike Bush, has an excuse. But Hoover did believe that in the middle of bad times, you have to balance the budget. He believed that cutting spending. He did believe in helping the banks. In fact, he gave a lot of money to the banks. And then the banks, facing economic crisis, didn't lend the money to anybody else. Sound familiar? Does this remind you of anything? As Harold Meyerson points out in an article in the Washington Post, Hoover believed that the private sector, and only the private sector, could save the economy. So he wanted to help big business as much as possible. And big business turned around and tried to help out by firing lots of workers and closing down factories. Strangely, that didn't help the economy. Fast forward 75 years to the General Motors and Chrysler and Ford executives appearing before Congress and blaming the unions, the workers, for the current economic crisis. Now, I mean, I know that's Republican mantra, but does anyone really think that Joe assembly line guy struggling to feed his family, screwing in the bolts on the Humvees that no one wants to buy, that it's his fault that we're in an economic depression? Well, I guess the right believes that, because they're calling on the unions to make more sacrifices. They don't seem to understand that, you see, workers help the economy grow. You know, I could say a lot of nasty things about Henry Ford. He was a vicious, racist, and anti-Semite. But one thing he definitely understood was that he had to pay his workers enough, the assembly line people, enough, so they could buy his Model Ts. It is, and I repeat this often, but it always bears repeating, it is the middle class and the working man and woman, that are the engines of the economy. Because there are only so many luxury yachts you can buy. So cutting union pay and firing workers is exactly what harms the economy. Take out for a minute all this, you know, where we're liberals and we care for working people and we have compassion. Throw it all out the window. We all know, you know, George Bush, the right wing, they hate compassion. Compassion's a bad thing. We only have compassion for fetuses. Only for fetuses. Once they're born, let the kids die. But throw out compassion completely for a minute. Let's focus on pure economics. What makes an economy grow? If you do what Herbert Hoover did, and you help big business while big business fires workers, and you give money to banks while banks stop lending, so that the middle-class American can't buy toys for Christmas, then you know what? You hurt everybody. Because if they can't buy those toys, and they can't buy those cars, then there's less demand, and then it doesn't matter how many cars that GM or Ford or Chrysler puts out. Nobody's buying them. And the companies fail. It's basic economics. I mean, it's striking, and I know it goes against everything conservatives believe in, but when you show compassion, when you actually believe in, here it goes, spreading the wealth around, as Barack Obama so ineloquently put it to Joe the Plumber, it actually works. Compassion actually helps the economy. Maybe it seems counterintuitive that a good deed could help a lot of people to Republicans, but it does. It works. I can prove it mathematically. And yet, there they go. They're going to try to take it out of the union pay. Great idea. So there are the car heads, hat in hand. At least this time they decided to drive rather than take their corporate jets. Okay, all right, good for them. And they're going to get a bailout. And they should get a bailout. As long as they put the money to the right things. And it seems that this time the Democratic Congress is pushing them to do the right thing, to build cars that have higher fuel mileage, to get rid of the Humvees, to build lighter, faster, cheaper cars, to compete with Japan and Europe, to build the cars of the future, hybrids and electric cells and fuel cells. The Democrats are holding their feet to the fire, and well, they should. And it seems that they're actually getting it. Good news. But not Bush. No. Bush won't support it. Bush will veto it. He's not going to help homeowners with their mortgages. He's not going to help bankruptcy judges reduce the burden on homeowners. You know, again, basic economics. Forget compassion for a minute. When a bankruptcy judge determines that a homeowner can pay back the mortgage if you just reduce the payments a bit, sure, that helps the homeowner. I admit it. Yes, it helps people stay in their homes. Call me bleeding heart liberal. But you know what? It helps the banks, too. Foreclosure is expensive. Lawyers are expensive. Courts are expensive, and those things are put on the chopping block. They're sold at auction, and you know what? In this market, they won't get very much. Banks will probably lose half or more of the loan if they have to foreclose. Whereas a bankruptcy judge will give a haircut, and banks will get 80 to 90% of what they loaned. So yes, of course it's better for the homeowner who stays in their home, but it's also better for the banks, you see. It's better for the economy. That's what Herbert Hoover didn't understand. That's what George Bush doesn't understand. And it's what Barack Obama does understand. So why aren't people out there demonstrating? I mean, there were anti-war demonstrations. There were Katrina demonstrations. Gay people are demonstrating, quite rightly, because of the horror of Proposition 8. Why aren't there, you know, there used to be Hoovervilles, these shanty towns in front of the White House. Why aren't there Bushvilles? I think the reason is, well, people just assume Bush is incompetent and evil. There's nothing to protest anymore. Obama's around the corner. Everyone's looking to the future, and no one's focusing on the present. And I get it. I understand it. I really do. I have Bush fatigue, too, but we have 47 more days here. We're already entering a recession. It's official. We've been in recession a year now. I remember having Mike Lane on my show about 6 months ago where he said, well, you know, it's, there's no concrete proof we're in recession. And I said, Mike, we're in recession. And he said, there's no proof. Well, there's proof now. Okay, we've been in recession for a year. I'm not surprised, but maybe the spin doctors are. Gene from Oregon. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
How's it going?
Going good. What are your thoughts?
Well, you would brought up the unions earlier, and I kind of a little bit PO'd today because I was listening to the news. I was getting up, and they had Mr. Sweeney from the United Auto Workers on the news clip, and he had gone before Congress to kind of speak on behalf of the auto companies to get the loan.
Right.
Now, I understand the need for him to do that. The jobs are online, and I understand that. But I hope, because basically in the mainstream media right now, they're pushing this meme that the unions are going to have to, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. They're going to have to give up their job bank and the pay, you know.
All the things they worked really hard for over decades.
Yeah,
I heard a reporter from Forbes. Did you hear this reporter? Asked the union guy, the head of the UAW, well, you got your strike fund. Why don't you just give up your strike fund? $1 billion in your strike fund. And I'm thinking to myself, $1 billion. You know what? If you add all the CEO's salaries, all the members of the board and the people in management, it's several billion dollars. And they're only, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 people, rather than an entire industry.
And I get so sick and tired of them trying to, they make $70 an hour and it's so damn high. I felt a little mad at Mr. Sweeney. I understand why he did that, but I felt, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But I felt a little mad that he had to be put in that position to show for those automakers to keep their jobs. And I'll tell you this much. I'd say, okay, you want to have the union and give up the job bank and the strike fund and all that stuff? Fine, then we want an increase by, say, 50% in the actual running of the company. I mean, basically,
I got a better idea. Give the workers the company.
Yeah, that's...
Let them own it.
Give the workers
the company. Fire the management. Let the union bosses run the company.
Yeah,
I
would do that, except the only reason that I wouldn't do it is simply because the Republicans would scream socialism. Well, you know what?
They can scream all they want.
They can't do any worse than what the CEO's done. So I'd make the right wing have to give something if they're gonna want the unions to back down and at least, you know, turn the doggone thing into a co-op. I don't care, but you know what? If they're going to say, okay, you're going to have to work for these lower wages and stuff, then you ought to turn around and say, okay, because we're going to do this, well, you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to go through us to make your decisions on how you're going to run this company now, because basically it's our skin in the game, and you made us do this, therefore we're going to exact something from you, and make the doggone conservatives have to, you know, make it some kind of choice. Now, I would give the company the union myself, but I mean,
I'll tell you something. Fox News has its mantra. It's been, I sometimes I turn it on just to see what the other side's thinking. It's the same reason I have Mike Lane on my show. People wonder sometimes. But I do believe you have to study the enemy in order to defeat it. You have to study those that disagree with you in order to, you know, listen to their... And Fox News is constantly bashing the unions. If they had anything to do with the current economic crisis. They had less than zilch, right? I mean, I guarantee you, the worker on the assembly line doesn't decide to make a Humvee. That doesn't come from him.
When I heard this, though, this morning, this wasn't Fox News. This was ABC. This is supposed to be the non-partisan media. I mean, you and I know it's
what did they say on ABC?
Well, just basically, they had him. They just had Mr. Sweeney. They're speaking in front of Congress about that, and then the commentator came on, I guess I call him a commentator, and basically kind of made an allusion to, you know, they wouldn't have this. It didn't. It was kind of implied in the coverage that they wouldn't have this problem. You mean they didn't have this?
Well, the idea is to put one worker against another, you see.
Yeah.
There will always be people willing to work more cheaply than we. Some of them live in, you know, slums in India, and I'm not picking on India, but it's a fact. There are lots of poor people
yeah.
there in Thailand and all over the world, all over the globe. There are always people who are so suffering that they're willing to do almost anything to get a job.
Oh.
And the idea is to bring everyone down to that level. I heard the UAW union chief say that's what they're doing. It's a race to the bottom. When we have the greatest difference between CEO and average worker of any industrialized country on earth, far more than Europe, far more than Japan. I mean, they want to take the $1 billion strike fund. As I said, $1 billion, that's what, 3 CEO years, including their bonuses and stock options? It's nothing to them. And yet this is what sustains workers all across, knowing that if they don't get the deal that they should get, they can go on strike. This is vital money to them. It was an amazing question to me, this Forbes reporter. It was, and I don't know. To me, if I'd been the union boss, I would have jumped down her throat. He was remarkably...
tactful.
Yeah, tactful. Yeah. He was. He was restrained. He said, well, you know, I don't think $1 billion would actually make, a difference. First of all, under the Constitution of our, you know, that we're voted on, we're not allowed to do this. But furthermore, I don't think actually it would make a bit of difference. It's actually a drop in the bucket compared to the real problems that these companies face. He said, if we didn't pay workers anything, if we ended all workers' salaries tomorrow, that still wouldn't get the auto companies out of their mess. They're developing products no one wants to buy.
Yeah.
And I don't care how many workers work hard to make products that no one wants to buy. It's not a good business model.
Well, I just hope whatever happens to this, I got the one lesson I want the unions to take away from this is, hey, if we're going to have to give something up, you're going to have to give up some of your decision-making power.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you this, so far, it appears the Democrats are pushing the auto companies in the right direction. Again, I want to see the fine print. I want to see the final deal. But from what I read in the paper today, it does appear that, you know, lowering corporate salaries, getting rid of the corporate jets, changing their cars, getting rid of the Humvees, going to cars that are far more efficient in terms of gas. I mean, it does appear that the Democrats are insisting on the right changes. What will be interesting, though, is even if they do that, I suspect George Bush will refuse to sign the bill, and we'll have to wait 47 days. And, you know, a lot can happen in 47 days. We've got the holidays coming up. This is the biggest market, you know, commercial time of the year. Consumers, if we can't buy for the holidays, then even if we bail out the auto industry on January 20th, 2009, we may be in a sustained depression for a good year now. So, it'll be interesting if the Democrats pass something. I think they should pass the right thing. They should they should get it up to President Bush's desk, and if he wants to veto it, that'll be one of the most memorable vetoes in his awful presidency. I think they need to, you know, call him on the fence and say, "All right, we dare you to veto it." And if he does, well, that'll be the end of his nasty legacy.
I hope so. And there is one request I've got. I've been watching this whole push for the Republicans. There's this new progressive Republican group on the web that I've been kind of watching.
Progressive Republican? Wait.
Yeah.
That's an oxymoron. Well, what does that mean?
There
hasn't been a progressive Republican since Theodore Roosevelt. What's a progressive Republican?
They hearken back to that.
He was a good president. I'm not going to attack Teddy Roosevelt. He was pretty good.
I guess. But, I mean, my argument is that when they get these quote-unquote progressive Republicans on here, it's still not going to do anything because basically they're going to turn the progressive Republicans, which I'm sorry, progressive Republican is not the same as progressive Dem or progressive somebody on the left. Because
Dean, you know what a progressive Republican is? A progressive Republican, it's a compassionate conservative.
It's
an oxymoron. It's a peaceful war. It's a freedom that's full of slavery, and it's ignorance that's full of strength. Compassionate conservative, progressive Republican, peaceful war, all of military intelligence, they're all oxymorons. And anyone who believes in it, well, they're a moron, too.
Well, yeah, but I think it's worth trying to cover it, because basically what I'm thinking is that the mainstream media, they'll tap them on the shoulder as a representation of progressive thought. I'm sorry.
It's all jabberwocky. They're all just trying to play with our language. It is fury, and the sound of fury signifying nothing.
I hope so, but if they've got to be, I mean,
they're going to co-opt every phrase we can do. I mean, you heard John McCain. He's the one who wants change, don't you know? He's the one who's gonna change things. I don't think the American people are that stupid anymore. At least I hope not. I mean, they still voted for Chambliss down in Georgia, but you know what? Those are Georgians. I mean, we understand that that Republicans still control, you know, a certain religious white male Confederate that's down in the South. But that is about the left supporting that party. So I can't sound surprised by Georgia. But I think that is where it will go before it hits the dustbin of history, unless they radically change and recognize that, oh, maybe they need to care about ordinary Americans, too, and not just certain religious
crazy. I suppose that the Georgia bit is proof that, like Bob says, with coal, with mountain cover, we're all downstream, and maybe the mercury all concentrates down there or something. I don't know.
Hey, thanks for your call, Gene. I appreciate it. Always
good calling. See you later. Bye-bye.
I'm going to take a quick break if I can, because I want to find this clip on George Bush and Charlie Gibson. So I'm going to look for the clip of the break, and I'll bring it back to you right after that. If you want to call in, it's 888-488-MARK or 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. It's a relief just listening to Barack Obama talk sometimes, especially on the economy. After 8 years of a boastful ignoramus in the White House, we're finally getting someone who not only speaks English, but also speaks economics. Watching Obama address the governors the other day was a study in contrasts. Gone was the goofy, the snide, and the strutting of George W. Here was a calm and thoughtful man who understands the crisis that the states are facing and who feels for the human beings in those states who are suffering. Obama understands that we need to jolt the economy back to life, and his plan for doing so makes a lot more sense than the Bush reflex, which is to cut taxes for the rich and corporations at every turn. Obama, by contrast, is stressing the need to spend money on infrastructure and on aid to the states. We get a lot more bang for the buck on this kind of stimulus than on corporate tax cuts, according to a study at economy.com. Obama is also emphasizing green energy projects, another effective stimulus in a huge contrast to the oily efforts of Bush and Cheney. On January 20th, Obama will have the paddles in his hands, and he should go ahead and give the economy the big jolt that it needs. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I found in the break some of Charlie Gibson's interview with George Bush. I'll play some of it now. I won't be able to play all that I want to play, but that's okay. We've got 47 more days of this monster. Okay, monster. Maybe he's just incompetent loser. It's hard to tell sometimes, incompetence versus malevolence, as I said. But anyway, we got 47 more days of the worst president ever to serve the United States. And so I'll be playing this interview over the course of some of those days. Let me play for you, though, just some of the things that he had to say to Charlie Gibson. It's just fascinating to me how everything he describes is just not his fault.
Do you feel in any way responsible for what's happening?
I've been the president during this period of time, but I think when the history of this period is written, people will realize a lot of the decisions that were made on Wall Street took place over, a decade or so before I arrived in president, during I arrived in president. I'm sorry it's happening, of course. Obviously, I don't like the idea of people losing jobs or being worried about their 401ks. On the other hand, the American people got to know that we will safeguard the system. I mean, we're in, and if we need to be in more, we will.
But was there an uh-oh moment tonight? Could probably use stronger language than that.
Yeah.
When you thought this really could be bad.
When you have Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Fed say, if we don't act boldly, we could be in a depression, great depression. That's an uh-oh moment. But the question is it worth it to save the system, to safeguard the system? And I came to the conclusion, along with other smart people, that it is.
I found you to be an excellent political analyst and commentator.
They switched to the campaign. But did you hear what he said? You know, did you take any responsibility for the economy? Well, you know, I was president during this time, but this stuff's been going on for a decade or more. Decade. Who was president? Let's see. A decade before he started. That would be his father. Okay. Or maybe he's blaming Bill Clinton for everything. I'm not quite sure. But this is the president that was against regulation at every single moment. Oh, well, you know, I guess I hadn't really thought about it. Did I cause the Great Depression? Well, you know, I've been playing with my dog Barney and clearing brush, and I never thought about it. That'd be like thinking about whether the war in Iraq was right. And, you know, we Bushes, we're not big on reflection. Here's a more lack of Bush's reflection. He was asked what it was that he was not prepared for.
Texas, the only time I really didn't campaign for change is when I was running for re-election.
Let's talk a little bit about 8 years as being president. What were you most unprepared for?
Well, I think I was unprepared for war.
Unprepared for war? You were unprepared for war? 10 days into the White House, on January 30th, 2001, you may recall a map, the one disclosed by Ron Suskind in The Price of Loyalty, the one that comes from your former Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, that wonderful map of Iraq, where they divided up into 10 oil fields and give them all to various oil companies. I guess you thought Saddam Hussein would just give it to you without war, huh? Georgie? Is that what you thought? Really? You were unprepared for war.
Whereas I didn't campaign. I said, please vote for me. I'll be able to handle an attack. other words, I didn't anticipate war. Presidents, one of the things about the modern presidency is that the unexpected will happen.
What don't the American people know about?
I didn't anticipate war. The unexpected would happen. All I did was kept manipulating the intelligence to support the war until, well, you know, they finally came through and accepted accepted what I was trying to make them believe. Fix the facts around the intelligence. Oh, no, I didn't expect war. We'll play more of these clips over the next few weeks. It is important, I think, as we are excited about the new administration, as we rightly watch the new administration and police it when it does wrong. I love the way Mike Lane, if you heard the show yesterday, was already attacking Obama, and the guy isn't even president yet. He said yesterday, well, there's 200 things that Obama's already flip-flopped on, and of course there isn't a single one because Obama isn't president yet. But, you know, they're ready. They're ready. They're ready to make sure his honeymoon never gets started. But as we look to the new Obama administration, let's never forget the depths of despair, the incompetence, the people dying in a hurricane in Louisiana because George Bush's federal emergency management guy has got a hankering for Arabian horses and fancy meals, but can't be bothered when thousands of Americans are drowning. Let's not ever forget how presidents can manipulate intelligence to get us into war. It's a very difficult thing because there are real dangers out there. I want to talk at length even more about Mumbai because it is very troubling. It is troubling not just for what happened there. It is troubling for what can happen elsewhere. Could somebody take rubber dinghies up to our shores in California or Florida or Virginia or New York or Maine? There were only 10 people. Only 10 young men. Apparently, 2 were captured early. Really, 8 did most of the destruction. The 2 that were captured, they were in the train station. One is the guy that they've captured today, the one who fingers Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Pakistani terrorist group. And one was shot then and there. That means that there were 8 who did all the destruction in the various hotels, that murdered the rabbi and his wife in the Jewish center, that took the AK-47s in those cafes. I hope that we in the United States would do a better job than they did in India. Apparently, they used all kinds of global positioning systems. They had planned out their attack quite well. They had trained for many months. Terrorism is still alive and well. But there's no way to fight true and real dangers when the president is busy making up danger. How do you focus on real weapons of mass destruction? How do you focus on nuclear proliferation? The fact that just 2 months ago it was barely noticed in South Africa, intruders got into the main nuclear plant there where they have enough enriched uranium to create 100 atomic bombs, and they were barely stopped, and it got virtually no news in Pendava. That's scary. For all we fear biological and chemical weapons, frankly, they're not as dangerous as a cluster bomb or a landmine. An AK-47 is more dangerous than sarin or anthrax. It is. That doesn't mean sarin and anthrax aren't dangerous, but let's face it. Machine guns are more dangerous. There's only one weapon of mass destruction. There are lots of weapons of destruction. Guns, biological weapons, chemical weapons, bombs, explosives. Those are all weapons of destruction. There's only one weapon of mass destruction. It's called nuclear weapons. Are our plants safe? Are we helping India and Pakistan and South Africa keep their plants safe? Israel too? France, England, all of them. China, Russia? That's a real fear. If terrorists got hold of a dirty bomb, yes, that is a dramatic, awful fear. And one we should have, and one we should be careful about. And that's not something that's liberal or conservative, it's just a matter of practicality. But when you have a president that's willing to lie, to claim that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction when he doesn't, you might miss the real weapon of mass destruction, such as when Syria was developing its nuclear plant. We now know that without, beyond a shadow of a doubt, even the United Nations has confirmed, the International Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed, that Syria was building a nuclear plant. It's a good thing Israel took it out. A very good thing. And it would be a very scary thing if Pakistan or India or South Africa or any other nuclear country got their nuclear weapons under some terrorist control. The thing that always bothers me about terrorist acts in Mumbai and the lying of this administration is that we start conflating lies with truth. And then you find some on the right suggest that underneath every rock is a danger. Everyone should be afraid. We should invade Iraq because Saddam Hussein is a terrorist. No, he's not. Saddam Hussein is an evil dictator like dozens around the globe. But he wasn't going around and bombing. I mean, he did in the Iran-Iraq war. It's true. He did. He in the middle of a war, he attacked his own people and Iranian people, and he did some awful things. But in 2002, he wasn't going around killing innocent civilians. He wasn't promoting the kind of things that happened in Mumbai. That's not to justify it. It's just to point out that there are various levels of terrorism. He wasn't building a nuclear weapon. He was a minor figure. And those on the right are conflating minor and major until we don't know which side is up anymore. As if Saddam Hussein having a little bit of mustard gas left over from World War I is equivalent to building a nuclear bomb or to what's going on in Mumbai. And then there's some on the left that say that there are no threats. I've heard people say this. Al-Qaeda, there's no real threat. It's not true. There are dangers out there. The trick is to have a president, to have a Congress, to have a national security policy that can distinguish between real dangers and fake dangers. They can tell the Americans the truth. That instead of blaming intelligence, can use the intelligence to determine, oh, Saddam Hussein isn't much of a threat. Oh, in Pakistan, there is a major threat. And to do what we can do to help the democracy of India, really a heroic democracy. For all that I don't like the competing with them because they have such severe poverty and I don't like American jobs going over to India, but I've got to say, that's part of my provincial Americanism, I got to give a lot of credit to India. India has the second most populous country on earth, more than 1 billion people. In fact, they're rapidly approaching China. They will probably become the most populous nation within 10 years or so. They have dozens of different languages. They are mostly very poor. And yet India has maintained a stable, functioning democracy for 60 years, despite terrorism, despite wars. I got to give this country a lot of credit. I mean, we can talk about how it is the police, I'm sure, failed in preventing the terrorists. Hey, we failed on 9/11. That doesn't make me hate America. India's not perfect. But it needs our help. You know, it seems that we're never around to help struggling democracies. Oh, we gave lots of help to Musharraf when he was the dictator of Pakistan. He took our help. He took our $10 billion. He pocketed it. He helped enforce his dictatorial will. He didn't much go after Al-Qaeda. He did a few little things to make it seem good. Well, now Pakistan has a democracy. And unlike India, it's not a stable one. It's a new one. And it's not really in control of its territory. I have no doubt that the government of Pakistan, I have little doubt, I should say, because I don't know for sure. I have little doubt that the government of Pakistan didn't know about Lashkar-e-Taiba. There may have been some in the intelligence services of Pakistan, but I don't believe the civilian democratic government attacked India. If they did, that's another thing. But I don't think democracies generally send terrorist groups out to murder civilians. I just don't think you see that very often. Democracies like the United States will, in the midst of wartime, accidentally kill civilians when they're trying to kill other people, and that can be way over the top. I mean, we had certainly Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the middle of wartime, but I just don't see a democratic government sending 10 gunmen into a teeming city to murder men and women and children with no objective whatsoever. I mean, what was the goal of the terrorists? The only goal that I can see is to cause India and Pakistan to go to war with each other. That would therefore, in the middle of the chaos, make their terrorist group stronger. That's the only thing I could think of. No, I don't think the Pakistani Democratic government was behind it, but I do think that Pakistan doesn't have control over its entire territory. And the United States and India and indeed all nations of the world. We can go through the UN or not, doesn't matter. France, England, NATO. We need to make clear to Pakistan that it has to clean up its mess, or we will. And I say we, I don't mean the United States, I mean a coalition of nations. If Pakistan can't govern aspects of its territory, then maybe an international force should be there. Maybe Pakistan should recognize that and say, all right, this area is ungovernable. Fire at will, people. And then it will be understood that when India comes in and bombs training camps, that's not war. It's self-defense. The important thing is to not to do these things. Not military is always a last resort, but to persuade Pakistan that it's got to get its act together. And that may be through aid. But at least we're aiding a democratic government, not Musharraf. But you can't have ungovernable territory out there, whether it's in Pakistan or Afghanistan or anywhere else. That is why Al-Qaeda was successful. There can't be a no man's land where terrorists can train and prepare to do the horrific acts that occurred in Mumbai. Someone has to take charge here. And it's my hope that President-elect Obama will engage the world community so that we're not alone in this. But the world will recognize that what happened in Mumbai helps nobody. It doesn't help Pakistan. It doesn't help India. It doesn't help Islam. I mean, what do the Islamic extremists think? Oh, join our religion. We kill people. We kill innocent children. What a great religion. And so Muslims also have to stand up and say, these people aren't Muslim. These people aren't practicing peaceful Islam. We don't recognize these people. We excommunicate, to the extent they can, in Islam, these people. They are not Muslims. Al-Qaeda is not Muslim. They are renegades. They are evil. They are a perversion of Muslim. Muslims need to stand up, too. Terrorism continues. And unlike a war on terror, which is what George Bush always claimed, which is silly, it's a war on a tactic, we need to have a war on the conditions that create terrorism. A war on poverty, a war against intolerance. We need peace in a way that convinces people to work together of all different backgrounds and hues. And it is my hope that the next administration can lead the charge in that way. Hope you enjoyed the show today. We're going to do more of Bush's interview.